Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody. I've got 20 minutes. I'm going to speak for 9 or 10 and then have a Q&A from the audience, if that's okay with you all. I got to learn more from you than you learn from me. So, as Rachel said, I'm Bill Weld. I was a two-term governor of Massachusetts back in the 90s. I was elected with 50.01% of the vote as an underdog and ran for re-election, was re-elected with 71% of the vote. So we had a good run there. I almost ran for president in 1996. I've thought about it before. I've been a longtime student of the conduct of the office of the presidency, knew Mr. Reagan, both Bushes. I was deeply involved in both of Mitt Romney's campaigns in 2008 and 2012. So I'm not a stranger to the general precincts here. I have a lot of domestic experience, a lot of international experience, which I'll tell you about. But I'm not running because I think I'm the only person who can make a difference. I'm running because I'm troubled by the situation in our country, and I think we're at something of an inflection point. And I think the most urgent duty facing the next president is to seek to unify the country as opposed to dividing it. And there's a bunch of things you can do there. One is to do what Ronald Reagan did and the Bushes and certainly Eisenhower, who I don't really remember, but my parents' generation, wanted to make all Americans feel good about being Americans. And that's not what the current administration is doing in Washington, D.C. So part of what's feeding this lack of unity is that Washington is trying to divide the country as opposed to unify it, starting with religion with the Muslims, going on to race with the Mexicans being murderers and rapists, and an effort is made to have us be resentful about people from other countries, and even resentful about other groups of Americans, and that's not the way to go. So I think a start in achieving this objective of unifying people is to realize that, you know, in our country today, as a result of a lot of things, the rich are too rich and the poor are too poor. And that's not good for social cohesion. So I do think that an effort has to be made to make the federal income tax burden on the poor less heavy than it is now. It's really not fair. And, you know, I'm not one of those who's saying we're going to give everyone a guaranteed basic income irregardless of whether they're willing to work. That's the Green New Deal. That's on the D side. That's not my cup of tea. In fact, when I was in office, I put in a work requirement for welfare, and the welfare rolls immediately dropped by 60% in the state of Massachusetts. That became the model for the federal law. But I think we need to increase the earned income tax credit for the working poor to make sure that the door to the middle class is not slammed in the face of the working poor. That would, again, be very bad for social cohesion in the United States. And we're all one country, and we should feel that way. We shouldn't spend all our time listening to someone try to persuade us that some brown person is going to come across the southern border, the Mexican border, and take our job, further kindling economic insecurity, or harm our wife or our children. It's just it's demagoguery of the first order. So I think a move, and may I say on taxes, I never met a tax cut I didn't like. I cut taxes 21 times in my years in Massachusetts and never raised them. And the result was that the business community got the confidence to build the plant next door, to increase employment, to invest in the big piece of plant or equipment, and that helped unemployment. And in my first term, we went from the highest unemployment rate in the industrialized states to the lowest. So that's number one, unification of the country. Number two, I don't think we should seek to divide people by generation. The current policies are really disfavoring millennials and the Gen Xers. They're going to pay the bill for all the excessive things that are being done in Washington. They're going to pay the bill for the $1 trillion a year deficit spending. They're going to pay the bill for the $9 trillion added to the deficit by the president's last budget. Not going to be my generation. It's going to be the millennials, who are now the largest voting bloc. They're also going to reap the whirlwind from any failure to make any effort to reduce the carbon emissions of our country in order to prevent the polar ice cap from melting in the relatively near future. And, you know, climate change may be something of a misnomer, because climate does go back and forth, and we had a little ice age as recently as the 1600s, and this plays out in geologic terms. But it's not a misnomer to say that if we make no effort to reduce CO2 emissions between now and 2040, 2050, that polar ice cap is going to melt if we go up 2 degrees Fahrenheit every year. And the result is going to be huge storm surges on our coast, rearrangement of our coastline, a lot of shorefront property that's not shorefront property right now and doesn't want to be, melting of every single mountain glacier around the world, which is the sole source of drinking water for 300 million people. So we have to get more realistic than a one-word platform, hoax. The current incumbent likes having one-word platforms, wall, hoax. Means he doesn't really have to argue the issues, because he really doesn't want to, because he doesn't have a deep bench, so to speak, in terms of being able to debate on that. So those are a couple of issues that I think will appeal to millennials. Politically, my strategy is to try to get more people voting as opposed to less. You know, no more voter suppression. Instead, get more people in. Get more millennials voting. Get Gen Xers to vote. Get more women voting. And I don't mean just suburban, moderate women. I mean all women. If I were a woman today, I'd be plenty exercised about the statutes that have been passed recently saying, boy, if you're raped, you own it. That's your fault. You got to go bear the child and support that child. I'd like to see a 99-year sentence, not for the doctor who performs an abortion, but for the rapist who doesn't support that child. So other issues that I think we need to pay attention to, obviously the deficit spending. Can't have $1 trillion a year. Unfair to the millennials. I was ranked the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States when I was in office. In fact, I kind of think it may be Mr. Trump who's the rhino, the Republican in name only, because he's not a fiscal conservative. He doesn't believe in conserving the environment. He doesn't believe in free trade. He doesn't believe in all the things that the real Republican Party used to stand for. So I'm unapologetic about challenging him here, because I don't think he's a real Republican. So I'm gonna fight hard in all six New England states, then go to some friendly states out west like California, Oregon, Washington, back to the mid-Atlantic states. When I almost ran before, I concentrated on Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, of which I'm a native, and there's plenty of electoral votes to be gotten. The last bridge to be crossed will be the Rust Belt states, where Mr. Trump won the election last time by winning three states that you're familiar with very narrowly. But now we know a lot more about Mr. Trump than we did the day after the election last time. And if this was just early 2017, I wouldn't be standing in front of you saying, I'm challenging Mr. Trump for re-election. I don't think he should be re-elected. Because we didn't know enough. Bad as his inaugural address was, it was just one speech. But now it's been backed up by 2 years of action. Steve Bannon, who's his number one political guy, says, if Trump is re-elected, you're going to have 4 years of uninterrupted payback. Payback for what? That just means they're going to continue to lash out at people. And I really can't sit still for that kind of approach to the government of the United States. So that's why I'm running. That's what I'm going to focus on. And I'd love it, since I have to get to know you in order to have traction in Iowa, I'd love it if you would ask me your questions. Sir.
Governor, what kind of spending cuts do you think you have in mind to control the deficit in the out years?
So the question is, what kind of spending cuts do I have in mind to control the deficit in the out years? And the answer is, nothing can be sacrosanct. Entitlements cannot be sacrosanct. The military cannot be sacrosanct, and doesn't really need to be. On the military, you know, I believe in a robust engagement. I think it's Mr. Trump who's the isolationist. On the other hand, I don't believe in boots on the ground to go into another country every time we see something we don't like there. I think I've made that plain before. In terms of entitlement programs and other cuts, what you have to do is what I did in Massachusetts, which is called zero-based budgeting. You have to assume that every account in the budget starts at zero unless it can prove that it did good work the previous year. In Washington, they assume anything other than last year's appropriation plus 5%. They call it a cut. And what happens is that the D's want to raise social spending by 5%, and the R's want to raise military spending by 5%. So they get together and, quote, compromise, close quote, by deciding to raise everything 10%. And the president, this president, is absolutely not only sitting still for that, but he's cheerleading it. And my motto when I was in office and to this day is there is no such thing as government money. There's only taxpayers' money. It's not government money. And believe me when I tell you, those members of Congress and of the administration in Washington, they think it's their money. They don't think it's your money. It's your money. So that will be my approach in cutting the budget. And, you know, I reduced spending in real dollars my first year in office. In other words, cut the absolute dollars. And I was new to state government, so I didn't know there were sacred cows littering the landscape. I didn't even know there were cows. So I was able to do that, and I would bring that to Washington as well. Ma'am.
What do you think about the Trump plan to zero out refugee arrivals?
Yeah, the question is, what about the Trump plan to zero out the refugee and asylum program? It's just another inhumane example of the inhumanity of the Trump administration. Different countries have different approaches towards asylum. You know, I might not go all the way to France, which has this unbelievable asylum and refugee tradition, but we can do our share and pull our weight. Yes?
Yes, sir. Thank you for mentioning climate change. Climate Change Solutions are big in Iowa, where 40% of our electricity is produced by wind. We're 8,000 jobs in the wind industry and 2,000 jobs in the solar industry. What do you think about 100% renewable energy economy?
Well, I think we're heading in that direction. We're heading for the electric economy. We're definitely heading for a renewables-fueled economy. I think wind and solar, and in my part of the country, hydro, we want to have all that. The one place where I get off the boat from the Green New Deal in terms of the composition of the elements of the grid is I think we should go back to nuclear. And I'm not talking about huge nuclear plants built on top of a barrier reef, which is what happened in Japan. Talking about smaller plants. I know in upstate New York, the counties there are hungry for small nuclear plants, which are good employers and good neighbors. And people say, why don't they invent something that has zero carbon emissions and can produce almost limitless amounts of energy and power? And the answer is they did invent it a long time ago, and it's called nuclear. But I'm well aware of the primacy of the wind industry in Iowa, and I would be in your corner in making sure that wind is as incentivized as possible in the run-up to 2050.
Veterans,
I was sharing with some of you earlier that when the GIs who fought World War II came home, they had two sets of needs, education and health care. Congress took totally different approaches. In education, they passed the GI Bill, which meant anybody can go to any college they wanted. It was a voucher system, and it worked perfectly. It was probably the most successful domestic political program in history. For healthcare, Congress went the other way. One size fits all, top down. The government has to control everything. I mean, I'm on the libertarian side of the Republican Party. I want the government to control as little as possible. I want to maximize individual liberties, which includes choice, not just freedom from being enslaved. So my view is that veterans should be able to go anywhere they want for their health care and not have these waiting periods and difficulties in care. Yes?
How many Americans die every year?
Couldn't quite hear. The burden of cancer? Well, one thing I can say that may sound trivial, but the pain that's associated with cancer can be treated with CBD, which is an ingredient of marijuana, but it's not hallucinatory. It's pretty harmless. And, you know, it's been legal to study cannabis in Israel for a long time. So they've essentially been running a human trial of 20,000 people for the last 30 years. So we know what it can do and can't do. It's just been illegal to study in the United States because of reefer madness. But it absolutely cuts pain of cancer victims by 90%. And when CBD is introduced with cytotoxins, which are the tumor-killing agents, their efficiency is doubled in cancer victim. And that's not palliative. That's not just addressing the pain caused by cancer, particularly in the elderly. That's curing cancer, killing the tumor cells. Yes?
Would you invest in passenger rail, since you can't talk about climate change without talking about trains? You can put 5,000 people on one train. It's one train a day to Pittsfield, Springfield. What? I mean, come on.
No, I'm a rail buff. I've actually been a high-speed rail buff. I went all the way to Japan to the Central Railroad there and rode the maglev train. You don't even know you're moving. You're going 505 kilometers an hour. It's fabulous. It's the wave of the future, but I'm afraid it's awfully expensive in the U.S. But I ride the commuter rail to work every day. And if you live in the South Shore of Massachusetts, you pretty much have to. But I've long been a rail buff. The only question is expense. But I ran the trains west out to Worcester.
We don't have a problem when it comes to highways. There's six-laning I-35 over here.
No, I get it. And speaking of trends that are gonna phase out, we are going to an economy of electric vehicles. It's the electric society. If you look at the projections of fuel consumption, even over the next decade, they're projected to go way down. So our highways are going to look very different not so long from now. Electric vehicles and driverless cars. Yes?
What do you think happened to the rest of the Republicans like you? Because you don't seem around very much.
So what happened to the rest of the Republicans like me? Yeah, no, you might call them New England Republicans. And we're people who are fiscally conservative. We're worried about taxpayers' money. But socially, we're embracing and we're welcoming. And, you know, I said I was invited to address the Republican convention in Houston in the early 90s. I was a sitting governor, and I summarized my political philosophy as being, I want the government out of your pocketbook and out of your bedroom. For this, I was booed at the convention, so maybe that was a sign of things to come. But that is what I think. I think there are a lot of them still out there, particularly in New Hampshire, so I have high hopes for that state to launch me past Mr. Trump in an arc. And there are just a lot of people I know, old friends of mine in the Senate in Washington, who are keeping quiet because they think it's not in their political interest to stand up just now. And I'm not rubbing their nose in anything and saying, Louis, how can you? Don't you remember the good old days? Because I don't ask anyone to do anything that's not in their own political interest. But once I get traction, once I get movement, I'll increasingly be making news about where are the other folks here. And as I say, I think if they don't stand up and be counted, they're going to be defeated. Yes, ma'am.
What is your stance on assault weapons?
On assault weapons, you know, there's 300 million rifles out there in private hands. My stance is not to have a supercharged background check on everybody every time they buy a gun, because I don't think that's where you reach the shooters, the El Paso shooters. I think the red flag laws, co-workers, family members say this person has been making threats, had a list of people he wanted to kill since high school, has violent behavior, is exhibiting neurotic behavior. Yeah, get that person in front of a judge. You do need to have a due process protection for the accused. But I think that would be a giant step towards preventing the mass shootings that we're talking about. And you can do research. You know, 90% of mass shooters grew up in a household without a father. A very good predictor of mass shootings is previous violent behavior. Give the FBI some more money to scout out these instances with the help of people who can talk about it. But I hate to say it, it may disappoint some, but the idea of universal background checks and trenching on someone's right to own a gun owner, and I own a gun, and I've been a gun owner and a hunter my whole life.
But you would not ban semi-auto?
I wouldn't ban a five-shot semi-automatic. That's the...
All right, but what about huge magazines?
Oh, no, no, that's different. That's getting towards an automatic weapon. It's already the law that you're not allowed to own an automatic weapon, unless you're a federally licensed firearms dealer. So that's taken care of. And no, I wouldn't allow them to become freely saleable at all. Thank you so much, everybody.